Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is insight number 132, allaboutsymbian.com. We're recording this on Friday, the 20th of August, 2010. I'm Steve Litchfield, and with me in Sussex, I have...
Rafe Blanford.
In Hull, I have...
David Gilson.
And up in Edinburgh, I have, of course, the inimitable...
Ewan Spence!
Yes, always a
big... That sounded quite enthusiastic there, didn't it? Wow.
I've been away for a week, so I'm rather out of touch. I'm hoping these guys are going to fill me in as I run through the week's stories. I've been away in the wilds of Devon. It's quite amusing to me, just as an anecdote, the tech blogs in London and the Bay Area in the USA, all these podcasts, they talk about, well, this phone's got 7.2 megabits per second download. It's got to be better than the one with 3.6 megabits per second download speed. Where I was, it's not particularly away from civilization. I was in a town of 20,000 people, and I was getting three bars of GSM at about 20 to 30 kilobits per second. And in some places where I was actually staying, I had to walk up two hills and stand in the freezing wind in my wellies and with my raincoat on to get two bars of GSM. And if I was lucky, about 5 kilobits per second. And it's just somewhere in between these two extremes, there is the average... every man's experience of data. But do bear in mind, when you listen to tech podcasts, sometimes they're talking from the uber elite end of the spectrum, and sometimes it's possible at the other end to have the very opposite experience. Any comments, Rafe or Ewan?
Well, back in my day, we had 9.6 BBBS, and we were thankful. We didn't even have sack cloths to make money. Anyway, but I think the point here is that there are lots of variable speeds in spec lists, and I think this is more to do with the bill of materials issue. You can have a faster or lower speed CPU chip and communications chip, and it doesn't make a material amount of difference to the end user in the average circumstances. But what it will knock off is, if it knocks $2, $3 per unit off the bill of materials, it's a huge saving to put a, say, 3.6 3G chip in there as opposed to a 7.2.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. It's what happens when you live in a rural area. I live with it on a regular basis and hang over a hedge to get a signal working. Thankfully, microcells do offer something of an alternative for people around the house, but of course that doesn't work on holiday. But it's important to remember, outside of cities, the idea of always on 3G connectivity is not there, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. Now, of course, 80% of the population is covered by reliable 3G signals, but the point is that 80% of the population will spend time in that 20% area that isn't covered, and so services need to, you know, make sure they take note of that in the planning stage, because, you know, you can't assume an always-on connection, even if the majority of the time, the majority of people do have a pretty solid connection these days.
Yeah. And just thinking about what you do with that connection, one of the things I found very frustrating in an area of low bandwidth, even when I had, you know, three or four bars of GSM and a reliable GPRS data connection, I would be browsing Gravity, looking at people's tweets, and people would be linking to websites. So, of course, I tap on the appropriate link in Gravity, brings up web with the website, and it just sits there, and 100 kilobyte, 200 kilobyte, it gets up to 500 or 600 kilobyte. And I know I've mentioned this on the site before in articles, but some of these modern web pages, they have up to a megabyte of code and CSS and JavaScript before anything meaningful gets rendered whatsoever. And it's so frustrating. And so I guess that's yet another plug for Opera Mini, which we all love, and is a great tool to have installed for backup purposes, because you just paste the URL into your Opera Mini and down comes the web page in about 60 to 70 kilobytes typically, which is wonderful. But do look on the site for an article going over my away in the world's experiences in more detail in the coming couple of days. On with some news. Hot off the press, I was put up on the site as we record this, a vFestival application. If you want to see the likes of Kasabian, the Kings of Leon, Paul Weller, the Pet Shop Boys, and many others, you may be at the vFestival, which I think is this weekend, Rafe. And there's now an application which you've been looking at.
Yes, it is this weekend. So for people listening to the podcast, the vFestival has already taken place. But the reason I wanted to mention this is because I actually think it's a great example of how a well-executed mobile application can sort of add real value to a real-world event. And we often talk about this sort of merger of the physical and the digital worlds and how mobile can enable this. And I think something like a application for a specific sporting event or a festival, or it could be, you know, like a guided tour of a castle or whatever it happens to be, can add real value. So within this application, for example, you've got a map of the site with this rather clever idea that you can mark points of interest on it. So, for example, you can mark where your campsite is or where your tent is, because I think we've all probably, those of us who have done this festival thing, have come across the problem of not being able to find where you left your tent, or, you know, agreeing somewhere to meet up with friends, etc., etc. So I think that's a nice touch. How well it works out in practice remains to be seen. But there's also this social element where they've got the live Twitter stream, live pictures coming in from Plickr, a YouTube channel, adding that kind of extra layer of social dimension, if you like, to the event. And it reminds me of something I've seen out of the Nokia Research Labs, is kind of the next stage on from this, how mobile phones could potentially be used to create ad hoc social networks around specific events. And, you know, these festivals and big live events like this have this peculiar sort of dual-sided nature. If you go with friends and can be a very social thing to do, but you're in a massive crowd who doesn't really know each other, doesn't interact. But by using mobile technology, at least potentially, you can create mini social networks or sort of mini networks for these events where people can then share tips, information, or just chat away, or sort of kind of like the back channel that you get on tech conferences, IRC, you know, for IRC back chat, which I think for those of us who've experienced this, will always say it adds a significant extra dimension. But if you can do this with a mobile application, it's a way to easy to use, you can open this up to everyone else. So I think VFestival app, which has come about as a result of Nokia's sponsorship of this festival, is an interesting one to just go and look at if you're interested in how this thing goes along. I mean, there are some other extra features that kind of add on to the idea of doing more than just something like a paper program. You know, you've got a customized schedule where you can sort of work out whether there's going to be clashes for things you want to go and see. You know, it brings in live weather information, kind of essential at festivals, I guess, these days, as well as travel information for when you're on your way and leaving. And it's being well executed. I mean, one of the things I like, for example, is there's a tie-in to Ovi Maps to help you get to the festival and all that kind of thing. So, you know, well thought out, well executed. You know, clearly this is a branding exercise rather than anything that's aimed at being directly economically profitable, but we've said before these kind of branded applications are something we expect to see a lot more of in the future, because with the race to zero in the app stores, you know, purely commercially driven applications in terms of buying and selling at a certain price aren't always going to work. So well worth checking out, and the we've got a summary of it on the website, but you can also download this from the Ovi store. Just put in festival or VFestival into the Ovi store search engine.
What's also worth pointing out here is the fact that it's been done with the Virgin Mobile handsets. Yes, okay, it's a Virgin V Festival and Virgin Mobile, but that's, they're separate companies using the V name, but they're working together. And it's the fact that they actually released a branded version of the Nokia 5230 handset as well, the 5230 V. In other words, they were selling a specific smartphone for a specific event. You know, again, yes, it had the covers in the back and it had the wallpaper, and it had the application pre-installed. But one of the great things about the race to almost zero in the handset market is that they're supplying literally a disposable smartphone for just the festival. You buy the 5230, you charge it up, it's going to go for about two days or so, which is how long the festival is running for. You pop your SIM in it, you use it, great. If it gets covered in mud, broken, doused in beer, smashed in half, got thrown at the stage because you thought the Clash were actually going to be playing when it's actually something else, it doesn't matter. You can leave the 600 quid smartphone at home. This will give you pretty much 95% of the functionality, and if it, you don't have any worries about it. And I think that's just as important as the software exercises that is obvious from that. It's the fact that the networks were working with Nokia to create a one-off that only really has relevancy for about 3 weeks leading up to the festival and the festival itself.
Yeah, no, it is an interesting one. I think this kind of cross-promotion is something we'll see more of. I'm not sure from an environmental point of view, I'm terribly keen on the idea of buying a handset to be disposable. But clearly, as the prices go down, it does become more realistic to see this kind of thing happening and people going, well, yeah, you know, let's take a disposable phone along to these festivals. Now, I think possibly most people would hope to keep on using it afterwards. And it is worth pointing out, of course, this app is available for anyone with a Symbian One phone. But clearly these kind of cross-industry tie-ins, which is obviously made easier by something like the umbrella band of Virgin, is a very interesting thing to see. And I'm sure we're going to see more of it in the future.
Moving on, well, you may have seen on the All About Symbian main site, David Gilson's three-part review of the Nokia C6, hot off the press. He's got the black version, It's basically a side slider, full width QWERTY keyboard. It looks pretty decent. Some E series features, some N series features, all rolled into one. One consumer-friendly device, if I may put it that way. David, you ended up giving it a recommended rating. How do you think it rates in terms of value for money, and would you buy one right now?
I wouldn't buy one right now. My advice to people would be to wait. The nearest funds that you can compare it to is the 5800, which is settled at around £190, and the N97 Mini, which is about £300. And at the moment, you're looking about 240 or 250 for the C6. So in my opinion, I think you should wait a little while, because I think you, Steve, predicted a mark of about 220, which I agree with, and I think it'll get there before too long. The third part of the review, which I'm sure everyone's read it, and if you haven't, go and read it now. That looked at the user experience and application suite. And the application suite, there's not a lot to say, because if you've had a Symbian 1 5th edition phone before, there's not a lot of surprises. There's one little thing in the browser. They've added like a dual URL and search bar, so you don't have to kind of navigate to your search engine of choice.
Although don't forget, David, that the people who've used to things like 5800 and the X6, they won't have seen the home screen widgets before in the panels. That might be new to them.
Yes, this is true. But C6 is the third phone to have that system. I'm kind of hoping to see that on more phones. I think there's a lot of 5800 users out there really asking for that to be imported. Your riff?
Yeah, it's worth pointing out on the C6, there are a number of sort of software features that we've previously only seen on E or N series devices. I think you mentioned some of these in the review, like the smart dialer and the sort of video application, which I think was N series, whereas the smart dialer was E series. I think that's part of Nokia's approach to having basically a standard version of the Symbian platform in each of the respective versions, rather than having a custom one for each one. And that is a definite change. You know, what Nokia are doing here is looking to have one single version. I think the C6 is kind of a taste of it. We're going to see this much more obviously in Symbian 3. There clearly are going to be updates as you go along, but you can expect them to come into firmware more rapidly. And we certainly won't see the differentiation we used to see between the N and E series. And personally, I think that's incredibly welcome move. Talking about the C6 generally, I mean, I'd sort of agree the pricing is going to go down a bit. A lot of people have said to me, why would you buy a Symbian 1 device for something like the C6 when there are Symbian 3 devices coming along? And it doesn't take a genius to work out that there are going to be, various form factors, ones with QWERTY keyboards and other ones. And, we've said a lot that Symbian 3 is a big step up. But I think with the C6, you're going to probably find the prices competitive for quite some time to come. And, of course, the people that are going to be considering the C6 are pretty price sensitive and may not be quite so bothered by having the latest version of the Symbian operating system, whereas the higher-end users who are going to be looking at something like the N8 are clearly probably a lot more interested in that kind of thing. I mean, I think it's, there's a lot of criticism of the S60 UI, particularly in 5th edition, and sort of accused of being clunky, but it is quite mature now, and certainly when I used it, the C6 was pretty slick in terms of speed and performance. And once you get used to it, as we've said before, it works just fine. And there's a reason that the 5230 has sold, tens of millions of units, is because it's got an attractive pricing and a UI that people generally recognise. And I think that's an important fact here. The C6 kind of falls maybe into the middle territory a bit, but it's perhaps going to do better, I think, than people may suspect, despite the fact it's a late-on Symbian 1 device.
Yeah, would it be fair, David? I've been reading your reviews with interest, and I do get a sense that Nokia really have optimized Symbian 1 now to work faster. If you look at the early version of the 5800 and the early versions of the N97 firmware, they were pretty painful to use in terms of speed of operation. But you sound like this is pretty nippy.
Yeah, that's the overall striking experience of the C6, and it's why I would recommend it to people. It really is clear that have done some work in the operating system and really optimized it. So it is a pleasure to use. I think it was a line in my review. I said, whatever I want to do, it doesn't slow me down. And that is exactly right.
Yeah, so the C6, I think that's the end of the official coverage, but David will be sending it on, hopefully, to both Ewan and myself at various points so we can get our take on the device. And, of course, by the time that happens, we may well end up having the N8 and even maybe news of other future handsets. So, as ever, watch the space, and do look on the show notes for this podcast for all the links to the various bits of applications and hardware that we're looking at, so you can get to read our stories in full. Applications again, moving back to Foursquare in this case, there's a dedicated Foursquare application. People will have heard Ewan mention this various times over the last year or so. Ewan, how does this new app work? Is it a widget? How fast is it? And how effective is it?
It's pretty fast. It's a standalone program, and it works nicely, but still needs quite a few generations and iterations for it to be as comprehensive as other applications or even the mobile website. What's interesting here is it's not an official application, but it takes the same look and UI feel from the official applications that Foursquare have available for Android and iOS. Now, that is risky, in my opinion. It could be that developers are standing up going, look, why don't you just buy ours? Because it looks the same and everything else further down the line. At the same time, they are leaving themselves, I think, open to a lot of legal problems. The application itself, well, it interfaces with the GPS on the phone to get your current location. It then looks up the database of Foursquare and goes, these are things that are around you where you'll probably want to check in. You see the place you are, you check in, you leave a little message for your friends so they know what's going on. Lo and behold, there you go. You can see what your friends can see where you are, you can search your friends, and you can just make happenstance and coincidence your friend. Now, there are a couple of problems with that, because that's the vision of the application, but it does miss out on a couple of things. The first one is there's no search function built in here. So, for example, if I'm standing, let's say, in the centre of Edinburgh right now, with the Edinburgh Festival is still on, running till the 30th, there are 250 venues at the festival, and they're all within about a mile of each other. There are some outlying ones, and I'm sure somebody out there could prove me wrong on Google Maps, but the point is there's a huge density of locations going around, and not all of them are listed. It appears that the application is taking the top 20 or 30. So if I want to choose a location that's not on that list, if I was using one of the other applications, or if I was using Gravity's Foursquare plugin, I would use the search option. The search option is not there in this application at this moment in time. So that's a bit of an issue. The second issue is there's no sort of filter on your friends. You can't find out who's nearby. People within 10 miles, people who just checked in within the last 3 hours. So there are some issues that need polished out, but the application as it stands now is a very good foundation. The framework is there. It's talking through all the API calls. It does look nice because it looks like the official one. So there's, if you're the sort of person that uses multiple operating system handsets, then, you know, there is that sort of consistency that you have here, that it's always a good idea in application development. But I just feel the developers are doing a little bit of a gamble, and it will be interesting and intriguing to see what happens next.
Yeah, I have to admit to being a bit of a Foursquare skeptic is not really quite seeing the point of it all. Rafe, have you played with Foursquare at all and the various clients and ways of accessing it?
I've had a very brief look at it, but like you, I have to admit to being a bit of a skeptic. Having said that, you know, I said the same thing about Twitter, although I would point out that's still, relatively speaking, a niche activity. And a lot of the skepticism comes from I don't really have a particular desire to share where I am with people all the time. However, you know, I can see how addictive it can get, but it's probably worth pointing out there are quite a few other, you know, location aspects or startups who have done this sort of thing. GoWalla is the obvious one that springs to mind, and, you know, arguably they both grew out of the kind of ideas that Dodgeball pioneered very early on. Worth noting that I think one of the big players could relatively easily eat their lunch, so I was quite interested to see Facebook coming out with Places just a few days ago. I think that has all kinds of interesting implications, not least that by default I think Facebook is publishing checking into Places to your Facebook stream, which worries me from a privacy point of view. But Ewan, I'm sure you've had a look at the Facebook Places stuff. What did you make from that for kind of an infrastructure point of view?
What's actually very interesting from the Facebook idea is when Facebook announced Places, over the next 24 hours, Foursquare had the most amount of sign-ups and new members through their site ever. So It's not a 1-0 binary option here. Facebook are trying to push the just, you know, let your friends find out where you are, not you tell the world. And obviously Facebook has had numerous run-ins with privacy in the past. This is still such an early area. I mean, if you look how long it took for camera phones to be established, it's the cameras on, everyone, oh, great idea. And then everybody started working on what sort of infrastructure was needed around there, what Web 2.0 services, what hardware and such like. We saw the same with trying to get NFC going, and NFC is still kind of bumping along trying to find a solution. And location, yes, it's nice to be able to tell people where you are. Yes, one of the most popular things you do with the mobile phone is phone up somebody and go, where are you? But I still don't see these as being killer applications. I don't see these driving sales. I don't see these creating an addiction in the same way that email did on the BlackBerry, that gaming did on Nintendo, that, you know, remote access to your music did for MP3.com. I still... It, location is nice, but it still feels like a B or a C feature to me, and we're still trying to find out what the A feature is for location.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point, and we should point out that Foursquare, I think GoWater as well, are one of the sort of launch partners with Facebook on this place stuff, so there's a certain amount of integration going on. But I think what you're saying there, Ewan, is absolutely right. I mean, to my mind, location is about contextual data. And that's something that's inherent and always there in the background. So we need to find a way of the technology being kind of transparent rather than a push thing. Because at the moment, Foursquare is what I'll describe as a push technology, in that you go and check in specific places. That's something I think really needs to happen automatically in the background. But of course, there are all kinds of sort of privacy and security issues around that kind of thing.
What would be interesting to find out through the photo sites is how many people have set up their phones to tag location to their photos, because that's not a push area. That's an area that the phone can do automatically. I just wonder what the take up has been on that. And if we knew that number, would that have any implication on what sort of impact location automatically done in the background could have over the next 12 months?
Absolutely. You know, it's a good example of how that's just happening seamlessly. At the moment, most phones by default, you have to switch on GPS tagging. And I would suspect a lot of people don't do that. And if they do, they're not necessarily aware of it going on, the implications there in itself. And of course, the other thing about location is there isn't perfect universal location coverage. We mentioned earlier 3G coverage in this podcast. Actually, location has the same problem. You know, GPS doesn't penetrate inside buildings, for example. With mobile phones, if you don't have a signal, you're pretty unlikely to get a GPS fix, simply because you tend to need the kind of the almanac data in order to get that effective GPS fix. It can be affected by the weather, you know, thunderstorms or being in canyons in cities.
Oh, you could live in Edinburgh.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, location, in order to really work, is going to have to be a completely always-on service. So there are, you know, still technical challenges to be solved in that respect as well, which is something we should bear in mind as well.
Yeah, just one note. I'm always surprised that Google Latitude hasn't taken off more, being, you know, done by the big G. You'd expect that if anyone can do it, they can. But of course, the big thing, apart from privacy, is the fact that something you and I have been ranting on about recently, which is the fact that in order to have Google Latitude running on everybody's phones, that there needs to be an always-on data connection, pumping the updates back up to the internet. And always-on data, as people move around, means a much higher battery drain, especially if you're not, you know, right next to a cell tower. So again, there are so many obstacles to this taking off in the real world, with real world devices, real world people, with real world concerns and real world battery worries.
You mentioned Google briefly there. They announced this week that they've got 100 million Google Map users a month, which is a pretty impressive achievement in one sense, you know. But when you consider how many phones Google Maps is shipping on, we're talking all iPhones, all the Android devices, and of course it's available on clients on a lot of other devices, including shipping on other devices. So relatively speaking, when you look at the sort of installed user base of the application, that's pretty low. When you consider, in addition to that, that you actually have to specifically sign up and opt into Google Latitude, I'm perhaps not surprised that it hasn't taken off in a bigger way. And I think it's still the fact that most people just don't want to share that kind of information because they don't feel safe doing so. And, you know, whether that's perception or reality is open to debate. But you know, you're right, you know, it's going to take the big boys, it's going to be Google or the likes of Rocky with Ovi Maps who are going to get the scale to maybe make it happen first. You know, and you compare that to the number of users of something like Foursquare, which I think regular users as opposed to people who have signed up and had a go are probably, you know, active. We're probably talking in the region of about 5 million. I don't know. I'm sure Ewan can quote a figure better than I can.
I can, but it wouldn't be accurate.
Well, there we go. So, yes, you know, it's interesting. It's still very early days.
Yeah. Steve, I'm also intrigued by your comment of how come Google can't make it work because of Latitude. Just to give you a list of names of products that I've just picked up from TechCrunch: Google Buzz, Google Page Creator, Google Notebook, Jaiku, Dodgeball, Google Audio Ads, Wikisearch, Google Wave, Google Answers, Video Player, Web Accelerator, Google X, Google Catalog. They couldn't make any of them work either. So, you know, just because they've got good search doesn't mean they can implement every single product to the expected levels. It's still really difficult to do any service, irrespective. Previous performance is no forward guide to how you're going to be adopted by the Web 2.0 circles.
Yeah, but although having said that, the Google Maps for mobile, or just Google Maps on your phone, is a pretty popular application, and the downloads and the many, many millions, and Latitude kind of piggybacks on the back of that. So Google Latitude isn't a service, just an experimental thing in its own right. It's piggybacking on something which is already very successful. And certainly whenever I've used Latitude in the real world, with people actually around me fairly close, it has worked pretty well. As with one good point Rafe just made, which resonates with me, is the fact that a lot of the time people will be within buildings and out of GPS coverage. Therefore, the Latitude thing may just be a guess of where they were a few hours ago. It may not be entirely accurate. So yet another obstacle in the way of its success, I guess. Yeah, just going back again to the fact that Latitude means always on data, which means always on battery drain. And there was a story in the week which David posted with a headline: battery life is the top priority to 38% of users, something I think most of us can echo. So, David, do you want to just flesh that story out?
Yeah, this was a poll held on Nokia Conversations where they asked what is more important than battery life, and the options were nothing, connectivity, multimedia screen size, or device size. And just to run through the results quickly so that anyone arithmetically inclined can keep up with me, 38% scored nothing. That was the biggest vote. 25% got connectivity, 17% for multimedia, 13% for screen size, and 7% for device size. Now, I found this really interesting and puzzling because it was good to see that the biggest portion was battery life, because I think those people are right. Yeah. But 55% of people thought energy draining options were more important. And the lowest, the least popular option was device size, which is just a physical limitation. So very interesting. And I think it really just goes to show that while how people are using their devices, in that we call them mobile phones, but I think it's more that they're handheld devices. They're not really mobile, as in you're going out in the field for days. Because there do seem to be very few phones now that you can take out in the field for days on end. I'll just sort of refer to BP4L-based phones. So it's interesting and curious.
Yeah, as a point of interest, I went away on my week's holiday with three BP4Ls for the N97. So I was travelling with 4500. I also had in the rucksack the extended 3600 milliamp hour battery, the one that makes the N97 about 2 inches thick. So which gave me a grand total of 8100 milliamp hours. I was just gutted that the new ProPorter turbocharger, which they're bringing out, which is all top secret, but I guess I can leak it here first, they're doing a 5000 milliamp hour version of that. So if I'd had that, I'd have had 13100 milliamp hours of raw power. That
would have all I'm going to say on this is refer people back to the classic Yes Minister sketch of: Minister, we never start a survey unless we know the answer that we want.
It is worth pointing out that I think battery life is one of the most important issues, and yep, it's quite often understated, and it's the one that you actually start to appreciate when your phone does run out of battery after 6 or 7 hours. And it's one of those ones that I think at the high end sometimes gets ignored, but is very much more important to people on mid-tier and low-tier devices.
Absolutely, absolutely. A few more brief items before we finish. Nokia Messaging for Social Networks, possibly the most clumsily titled application in the history of civilization.
I'm going to go back in a minute.
Was a trial application to integrate Twitter and Facebook into a Nokia messaging-like interface. And it was up on Nokia Beta Labs for around about a year. But people's feedback has been implemented, and there's a integration into what they call the phone book in Symbian 3, or the Nokia's upcoming N8. I guess it's still going to look like a contacts icon on the screen, but it will have Facebook and Twitter integration right deep into the contact records, and there will also be social integration built into the version of Ovi Maps on the N8. Much of this is kind of guesswork until we actually get the N8 and get a Symbian 3 device for real, but they just say that if you were using Nokia messaging for social networks, you can't anymore because it is now closed and the servers have now been closed down. But in the meantime, there are Facebook applications, of course, in the store, not least Gravity, but there's also a dedicated widget. And there are other ways of accessing Twitter, of course. Any comments, guys, before I move on?
Yes. Daily sermonettes on Catholic faith and scripture is probably a slightly longer and more clunkier application name. That's available for the iPhone.
You can't resist a challenge, can you?
Nope. Not a stupid one, no.
Rafe, one last item. You did say you wanted to talk about something called SugarSync, which I'd never even heard of. Do you want to just flesh that out?
SugarSync is a backup and sync service, originally mainly aimed at PCs, the idea of being able to back up your PC to the internet or backing up to the cloud. There's quite a lot of those services around, but it's also got elements of kind of the Dropbox and Ovi Files type service, i.e., you know, being able to put files into the cloud and have them available wherever you want, whenever you want them. It's got some pretty nice syncing technology. Some of the times the speeds can be a bit slow. Compared to the Dropbox, of the free services, a bit limited, but there are pay for options as well. But the reason I wanted to mention this is they've just released a Symbian client, and I'd say it sort of adds a level of functionality above Dropbox and Ovi Files, because, as I say, it combines in this PC sync stuff. So well worth checking out. They've added some nice things into the client in terms of being able to access things from the magic briefcase. That's SugarSync's way of having a sort of special folder that syncs everywhere. But you can also have some quite powerful options of choosing what you sync. And as a way of accessing files on your PC on your phone, it's quite well done. You can download a Word file, edit it in QuickOffice, and then it will sync back to your PC when you want it to do so. There's also some rough edges to the client, notably in the mobile photos functionality, but well worth checking out. And interesting, because this has come over from sort of a client on Android and iPhone, a sort of sign that Symbian is starting to get a bit more support. You know, people have created their clients on other platforms but want to access the market, you know, that is generated by the Nokia market share. I noted that Simon Judge, a well-known mobile developer blogger, had posted onto his site, you know, his experience on this. He was seeing more Symbian projects come his way after being very quiet previously, and that a lot of it was a result of activity of people wanting to port their clients, their applications across from other platforms to access the market share that Nokia has, which, as you know, we've commented often on this podcast, is still very large. So an interesting bit there, and SugarSync will have more information on that on the site in due course.
We're right out of time, guys. It's been a pleasure, as always. Look for the show notes. If you're show notes, that sounds good. The show notes at allaboutsymbian.com and the appropriate news story. A reminder of our Twitter URL, Steve Litchfield. Don't forget the T in Litchfield. Rafe Blandford. Ewan, just E-W-A-N, and David Gilson. A reminder also that if you have a Nokia device and you have the Ovi store, then do look for both the AAS All About Symbian and the Phones Show widgets, which give you access to some of our content in our feed. So do go download those. But for now, it's a goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield. Rafe?
Goodbye from me, Rafe Blanford.
Ewan?
And it's goodbye from David Gilson.
David.
And it's goodbye from Ewan Spence.
Oh, well, you guys have got the hang of this. All right, catch you later, guys. Bye.